If you look at places like the building trades, the entertainment industry, these are good models to look to for what I believe the next generation of employee organization will look like. You go from job to job, you have a base wage, and built into that base wage are costs for health care and pension. That's enabled by my union that serves as the technically employer of record.
Welcome to the Alta Group Podcast on Real Estate. I'm your host, Tom Silva. Today, our guest is author, activist, and social entrepreneur Amy Dean, a leader in the labor movement for more than 20 years. As head of the 15th largest regional labor federation in the country, the South Bay AFL-CIO Labor Council, Amy represented 90 unions and more than 110,000 workers. Her latest book is A New New Deal, How Regional Activism Will Reshape the American Labor Movement. Amy, I want to address the whole issue of how the corporate world perceives the labor movement. But before we do that, what I'd like to do is have you give us a brief description of the history of the labor movement. How did unions get started?
As long as there's been any form of commerce, capital organizing itself to perform any kind of function in the economy, there's always been working people coming together to assert their own interests. As people moved out of the agrarian society and as with the growth of industrialization and mass production, a huge wave of demographic change in America as people moved into the urban centers of America to take the jobs of growing industry, steel and auto, rubber, machinery. As people moved out of the agrarian parts of society and into the industrial parts of industry was forming, there was a need for people to come together and to organize themselves, wages, benefits. These jobs in the industrial parts of the economy were not preordained to be high-paying, high-wage, high-benefited industries. They didn't become that until people organized. And the history is oftentimes not as romantic as people like to, you know, sometimes recall. I mean, the emergence of unions in these industries came about through oftentimes physical violence. Capital's never been open-armed about the need for employees to organize. I think ultimately when you present capital with the choice between onerous public standards of employment, like we see in European countries, versus individualized organizations that form along industrial lines, which is what we have today in traditional unionization, and you give people the choice, you know, it's public standards versus rights and responsibilities for groups to negotiate together on a local basis, industry will take what they see as the lesser of evils, but there's never been open-armed acceptance.
And yet there was tremendous support for unions during the 19th century. I mean, the Catholic Church, Adam Smith, who many people credit with being the father of capitalism, was a huge supporter of the unions because he thought it was a necessary corrective to the ownership class.
Which is understandable. I mean, Adam Smith's whole acknowledgement that there needs to be some kind of countervailing force to the forces of capital to have civil society is what I think has allowed unions to survive over these years. But I think we began to depart from that in the 1980s, where we really did hit a political moment in America where that notion is just no longer held near and dear to our hearts. There is no belief any longer that we need countervailing forces to capital.
So the thing that might surprise people about unions is that between World War II and the 1970s, relatively recently, there was really consensus on both the right and the left about unions. Eisenhower, Republican, acknowledged the impact of unions and said that the economic interests of employers and employees are about mutual prosperity. So the question is, why did both Democrats and Republicans support unions going into the 1970s?
We had a different economy back then. In the post-World War II economy, we had an economy that had insulated borders. We insulated industries. We believed that it was important for us to build up our industrial base, that we were in a position where we wanted to create economic prosperity so that we began to rebuild an enfranchised class that would rebuild our country post-World War II. There was a lot of there were social factors going on at the time as well. I mean, not only did we have an economy with insulated borders, industry that realized we needed to create a consumer class if they were going to sell those products within our borders, but our notions of social justice were very different then than they are today. We were a much more homogenous society. We had much more sense of common purpose, if you will, than we have today, where we're an incredibly fractured ideological society. And so the combination of our trade, the way we constituted trade, the need for industry to have a consumer class. In other words, it was a time in history where you could say what's good for GM is good for America because there was a mutual benefit.
So let's talk a little bit about the 1970s and the 80s. I think the two seismic events that people talk about in terms of changing the way labor relations operated were Ronald Reagan's firing of the air traffic controllers in 1981, and also Margaret Thatcher in England ending closed union shops and the miners' strike. So give us a sense of what was going on during that period.
Toward the 1970s, with the breakdown of insulated borders and as economies started to integrate themselves, as industries started to integrate themselves, it wasn't wholesale economies. With the beginning of steel and textile and apparel, as these industries began to negotiate bilateral trade agreements with other countries along the world, and as we started having our domestic markets cut into, there was increasing pressure to lower cost of doing business. And the one thing that you can take on is your employees. That's the easiest thing to go after. It's the one thing, you know, fixed costs are fixed costs, but you can go after human capital. And so the consensus began to break down at the middle of 1970s, and from that point on till today, we have no consensus about the way in which our economy should grow, what our obligations are to one another, and how best to compete under these conditions. I think we're in a big conundrum now in America. How on the one hand are we competitive, and on the other hand create economic enfranchisement for our people so that we can maintain civil society here in America and across the world.
So, Amy, what would you say to the corporate skeptic who says that the three greatest periods of growth in the American economy were the Gilded Age right after the Civil War, the 20s, and then really the 80s and 90s when you saw a reduction in the power of the unions and deregulation? So how would you answer somebody who says that it's exactly the reason that we were able to grow in the way that we did?
Well, I can tell you after spending 17 years in the Silicon Valley that we should look at that because that's sort of the epicenter of the environment that you describe. And what we saw happen in the Silicon Valley between 1980 and today, we saw the economy go through multiple revolutions. We went from a semiconductor industry to now what is almost exclusively a software and internet industry. And at the time that the economy was growing, you looked at what was happening among jobs, you take the heart of all of that, the 1990s, that you know, 6 of the 10 fastest growing occupations in the heart of Silicon Valley paid less than $10 an hour. And that the remaining jobs, the 4 out of 10, required a bachelor's degree and a few hours of on-the-job training. So you look at those numbers and you say to yourself, yes, here we are in the middle of a boom and we're creating enormous amount of employment, lowest levels of unemployment since World War I, and yet the qualitative nature of that employment is not allowing people to sustain a decent standard of living. People increasingly are working in jobs that pay $10 an hour or less, no benefits, part-time employment, contract employment, leased employment. The employment relationship began to change dramatically based on the needs of industry. And as a result, while unemployment was low, we saw growing numbers of temporary and part-time employment, something sort of what we called the shock absorbers in the ultimately flexible economy. So I think that what happened in large part in the 1990s and what continues to take place today is that the traditional economic measures of success that we use to determine how is our economy doing, how is industry doing, really no longer bear relationship to the success of communities and families and their well-being. So we once were able to say what's good for GM is good for our country because we had a linkage between economic prosperity and well-being and collective bargaining. Increasingly, industry can post record-breaking quarterly earnings and it have no relationship to employment in the region, no relationship to tax base in the region. And so as a result, you really can't argue anymore that what's good for Intel is good for America. America, because it may be that those economic indicators have nothing to do with what's happening in the community in which they live. And so what is truly at one time in America a huge growth period, in the end left more disparity between enfranchised classes of people and who's at the bottom today.
Part of the idea behind what happened in the 1980s and the 1990s was trying to make the U.S. a more flexible economy. A lot of economists believe that what gives America a great advantage over Europe is the fact that we have enormous flexibility in our labor markets. We can hire, we can fire, we can contract, we can expand pretty easily. And that's the reason that, you know, when, for example, the Greek debt crisis happened, there was enormous capital that flew out of Europe and came to the United States, partially because of the belief in the sustainability and the structural advantages of the American economy. How would you respond to the fact that, you know, there's a reason why unions have been disempowered a little bit here, because it creates enormous advantages for us versus other countries around the world?
Well, I think that we said earlier, we just touched on this, that the way in which industries restructured itself to be competitive in the global economy requires that it externalizes any cost within the firm. And so the need to be able to shed anything that's not core to the competency of the what the core business is becomes a pressure on the firm, creating the growing number of flexible, temporary, new work arrangements, and being driven by the need for, again, to get rid of any cost from the firm that's internal, and also the need to really be out there and catching the worm of productivity, because you are the fastest and quickest firm. I think that we're going to need to rationalize that structure again in America. We're going to need to be able to put some kind of constraint on that, which is, I know, not anything anybody wants to hear, if we really do want that kind of industrial arrangement to yield shared prosperity. And it doesn't today. It doesn't because it's a common story that we haven't gone into detail, but you've referenced it in several of your questions, which is the economy goes through massive change, and then every social institution has to catch up to restructure. Now, capital always is the first and fastest, and it's for obvious reasons. Capital reforms itself, it reshapes itself based on macroeconomic restructuring, and then social institutions are slow to catch up. So I would sort of characterize, where are we today in America? We find ourselves in a moment where we really have a declining social infrastructure, whether it's labor organization or education or public sector services. Even our financial institutions haven't quite figured out how to respond or, you know, adapt.
So let's talk about how the unions are going to adapt to the new world. I think you'll agree they can't go back to where they were. So what does the new union look like, and what concessions do they have to make in order to still be viable?
I think the next generation of employee organizations will look sort of like a crossroads between the occupational unions of the past and the professional associations that are growing today, performing a function where you're setting wages and you're setting standards for health care and pensions, but we'll do it differently. If you look at places like or industries like the building trades, the entertainment industry, these are good models to look to for what I believe the next generation of employee organization will look like. Where you go from job to job, you have a base wage, and built into that base wage are costs for health care and pension. And essentially, I have a traveling mobile pension and health care plan that's enabled by my union that serves as the technically employer of record. Now, because our labor laws are so outdated and were written at a time when America was transforming into an industrial era, we don't even have the legal infrastructure to allow for that kind of change. When I lived in the Silicon Valley, I always made it a point to be friends with industry leaders, always because it was important to understand what was on their minds. And so had very interesting conversations with people like Eric Benhamou, who at the time was heading up 3Com, Bob Saldich, who at the time was heading up Raytheon. And I would have conversations with them, and I would say, what would you rather have? A set of unpredictable conditions wherever you went in the world about the cost of labor? Or would you rather have predictability And on every single one of these occasions, John Chambers, every single one of these occasions, these folks would say, any day of the week, build in or bake into the cost of labor all these extras, so long as it's predictable for me. So long as I'm not wondering every time I go into a separate market what's going to be my situation with respect to labor. Because anybody knows, whether you're in the building trades, the entertainment industry, or whatever industry you're in, core to your success is trying to create as much predictability in this incredibly volatile environment. And so I don't believe that employers are inherently bad people. I believe that economics and the infrastructure in which we are forced to operate, which by law is not, by the way, is not governed by physical laws of nature. The economy is formed by personal human values and politics. And I believe that we can, once again, connect economic decision-making to values and at the same time enter into a new social contract, again, between employees, labor, and the government to create standards around employment.
Amy, one of the criticisms of unions is that they don't allow American workers to remain competitive within the global economy. There have been a lot of criticisms of the legacy costs, for example, of auto workers. During this financial crisis, there was one report that said that 25 American-based companies, in their attempts to lower their costs, eliminated 700,000 jobs in total, most of which they outsourced to lower-cost countries. How would you respond to someone who says that unions have helped cause the whole movement towards outsourcing?
I think the biggest misnomer and one of the biggest myths in America is that we began to outsource because of high wages of industry in America. And like I said earlier, it's been well documented at this point, and it's no longer up for questioning. But the first round of manufacturing that we lost in the 1980s, and you can look at Silicon Valley, where it was a completely non-organized industry. Silicon Valley moved all of its semiconductor manufacturing offshore. It wasn't even unionized. It was in a non-unionized area. And they took the majority of their semiconductor plants to Germany, to Ireland, high-wage, high-trade surplus countries, and highly organized countries. In the 1980s, the Reagan administration created massive tax incentive within our tax policy. That's why I say the economy is never run by physical laws of nature. We can incent capital to do lots of things through a whole set of mechanisms that the public sector controls, and one of them is tax policy. In the 1980s, the Reagan administration created fabulous incentives to move industry offshore. You were allowed to do it and then get reimbursed back from the government. And the more you spent to move your industries offshore, the more you got to write off your domestic tax bill. And what capital was fleeing wasn't necessarily high cost of labor. Capital was fleeing any popular influence that existed over its industry because it went to places that were highly unionized. Ask a place like Applied Materials how good their experience has been in China. They invested. It wasn't until 16, 17 years later that these companies can tell you, Selectronics, Flextronics, all these flexible manufacturing firms, these folks will tell you when they went to China, it took them over two decades to get halfway decent quality. And some of them even ask you, they tell you, we don't know why we stuck it out. So it wasn't until much later waves of outsourcing that began to look to places like Mexico. And by the way, it wasn't until the first round of outsourcing that you could even look to these other countries because there was no infrastructure to even to outsource to. So let me say that there are multiple forces that incent outsourcing to other countries, but the first wave that left this country did not leave seeking cheap labor.
And what about the notion that unions and unionized labor actually inflates the price of goods? This goes back to people like Friedrich Hayek, the famous economist who believes that. Well, how would you respond?
And I don't think that when we saw the decline of apparel and textile and steel unions in America, and as they started to decline, that the cost of those products were any cheaper. They weren't. So I think you have to be specific industry by industry. But the truth is that very little example of labor cost savings being passed on to the consumer.
Talk to me a little bit about the public unions. The 46 states right now have deficits totaling $112 billion. You have governors in various states battling the unions and trying to cut expenses. Well, how do you react to that?
We see all sorts of problems going on as a result of tax and fiscal policies that have failed at every level of government. And now we look once again to blaming and scapegoating employees. We scapegoat employees all the time in America, and it gets us nothing. We have massive tax and fiscal problems in America. For 30 years, we've had administrations who have said, government should not exist. Let's starve this beast to death. We have had 30 years of protracted efforts to eliminate the role of the public sector in any way possible. We have eliminated all the legitimate funding sources for government. We've got cash-strapped cities that go after the Walmarts of the world and chase cash registers because it's the only source of revenue that they can generate, sales tax. So you've got local municipalities and counties, the only thing they can generate for revenue is sales tax. You've got states that are crumbling all over the place, which isn't because of their public services and their teachers. It's because there is no revenue being passed down from the federal government. And we have a federal government that has very little role to play anymore because it has no resources but for a militaristic role and not much after that. So the problem is much bigger than what do we do with public employees? The problem is much bigger. Do we want to have state and local infrastructure? Do we want to have a federal government? What are the services in which we believe as a country should be provided wholesale? And that's the conversation we need to have. And I quite candidly think unless we're prepared to deal with the issue of tax and fiscal reform, we can have very little conversation in America about anything and any social agenda.
So if labor and unions do not represent the problem, Amy, last question, where do you think our priorities should lie? What is it do you think that's going to drive our economy, attract foreign investment, and make us competitive in the global economy?
We know that for the most part, although the economy is global and firms roam the globe looking for a place to situate themselves, but if you talk to industry, they'll tell you, what are the metrics that matter for a region in which I want to locate myself? And tax expenditures and giveaways are really not at the top of the list, in spite of what popular belief is, that capital roams the globe for cheap labor and for tax incentives and giveaways. Capital looks for, am I going to be in an area where land use policy is predictable? Am I in an area where there is rich infrastructure with respect to higher education? Am I in an area where the K-12 system is good? Do we have decent, affordable housing stock from the kinds of knowledge workers I want to compete and attract? Is there open space? Is there quality of life? All these things are what capital looks for when it situates itself within a region. Is there a good mass transit system? Is mass transit being planned on a regional level? Or am I going to be in some area where there's 16 cities and everybody wants to have a say over mass transit? These are the things capital looks for, and these are all things that are part of the public goods that we finance or don't finance. If America can't figure out how to rebuild tax and fiscal infrastructure so that we can build rich regional infrastructure, we will lose the majority of our industry, not because of fire and police and their pensions, not because of teachers and their pensions, but because of our inability to build world-class airports and all the things that capital needs to be successful in an area.
Well, Amy, thank you for being here today.
Fabulous questions, and I've enjoyed this dialogue discussion very much, so thank you for having me.
To listen to more Alter Group podcasts or to read our Alter Now blog, visit www.altergroup.com.